Good day, and welcome to the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice conference call. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the call over to Director Phil Keefe. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Cecilia, and good afternoon, and thank everyone for joining us today. I call the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and Administration of Justice to order. On behalf of Attorney General Barr, we thank you for joining us today for this important Commission teleconference meeting. I know it's been a whirlwind this week for all of us attending the executive order signing ceremony at the White House to a candid discussion with the Attorney General about how the work of this historic commission will intersect with the new executive order on safe policing for safe communities. As I've said before, the competing demands for your time are unprecedented, but the Attorney General, his leadership team, and the commission staff, and certainly Vice Chair Sullivan and I, are so appreciative of your continuing to make all the work of this commission a priority. On a personal note, at the COPS office, we were saddened to learn one of our most cherished staff members suddenly passed away Tuesday, Tawanda Elliott. Many of the working group members know her. Was a senior staff member with over two decades of service with the Department of Justice. Tawanda's trademark was compassion, and she was undeniably kind to all. She had contact with DOJ and the law enforcement field. She was instrumental in our community engagement initiatives at the COPS office more than 20 years ago and served the field with a tireless effort to help all those that she had contact with. We've expressed our sincere condolences to her husband and daughter and ask that everyone keep her family in their prayers. At this time, I'd ask our Executive Director, Dean Keeter, to conduct a roll call of commissioners.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd just like to add my condolences to Tawana's family. Shocked to learn of her passing. She was a dear friend. Before we start today's hearing and before I call the roll, I'd just like to remind everybody that today's event is open to the press and for any members of the media on the call. If you have questions or need clarification on anything, please contact Christina Mastropasqua in the Justice Department's Office of Public Affairs. And with that, I will begin the roll call. Commissioner Bowditch.
Here.
Commissioner Clemens.
Here.
Commissioner Evans.
Here.
Commissioner Frazier.
Here.
Commissioner Galtieri.
I'm here.
Commissioner Hawkins.
Present, thank you.
Commissioner Lombardo.
Here, thank you.
Commissioner McDonald.
Good afternoon, present.
Commissioner Moody.
I'm here.
Commissioner Parr.
I'm here.
Commissioner Price.
Good afternoon, I'm here.
Commissioner Ramsey.
Here.
Commissioner Rausch.
I'm here.
Commissioner Samaniego.
I'm here.
Commissioner Smallwood.
I'm here.
Vice Chair Sullivan.
I'm here.
And Commissioner Washington.
Here.
Mr. Chairman, that completes the roll call.
Thank you, Dean. We have 100% of our commissioners, and we appreciate that. Any other announcements today, Dean?
No, sir. We are good to go.
Thank you. Please note that we'll be posting the testimony and the bios of our distinguished panelists on the Law Enforcement Commission website today, or later, I should say, not today. We again want to acknowledge the work of the commissioners and working group and witnesses, not only today, but those that have come before the commission and the federal staff who supported the commission toward meeting the goals of this historic commission. And on behalf of Attorney General Barr, we thank each of you. As noted on previous calls, we encourage commissioners to take notes during the testimony of the panelists, and we'll then open for questions from commissioners after the last witness. Our first distinguished panelist today is Mr. Scott Turner. He's the Executive Director of the President's Opportunity Zone Revitalization Council. President Trump appointed Mr. Scott as Executive Director of the White House Opportunity and Revitalization Council in 2019, which was formed to better coordinate federal economic development resources in opportunity zones and other distressed communities. Mr. Turner previously served in the Texas House of Representatives from 2013 through 2017. He played 9 years in the NFL for the Redskins, Chargers, and Broncos, and currently serves on several community boards. Thank you for joining us today, Mr. Turner. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Keith and Vice Chair Sullivan. I really appreciate this opportunity to speak and testify before the commission today, and I want to say hello to all the commissioners and thank you for your service. As you well know, in 2017, with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act legislation that the president signed into law, the Opportunity Zones initiative was created. And I like to say, you know, from the root of this, when you understand the root of something, you can understand the objective and the purpose and the mission. And, you know, the question was being asked at that time, you know, what can be done for the most vulnerable or forgotten communities, forgotten people of our country as it pertains to economic development, education, entrepreneurship, housing, and all of these things. And so when the question came up, you know, how can we help? How can we partner together to help those in our distressed communities around America? Because there's 52 million people in our country that live in poverty. And as a result of this discussion being raised and the tax law being signed, the opportunity zones were created. And by way of the opportunity zone, the president formed what he calls the White House Opportunity and Revitalization Council, of which I have this a humble privilege of stewarding this council with Dr. Ben Carson, Secretary Carson, being the chair. And the purpose of this council is, as the chair alluded to target and to streamline the resources into opportunity zone projects, be it housing, be it job creation, be it the creation of new businesses or the expansion of existing businesses, to really streamline these resources into projects inside of opportunity zones to bring about real revitalization. Because the spirit of this law and the spirit of the council is both economic development and community development, to build up the economy, to create jobs, to help others own businesses and create jobs, but also to impact the community, whereby those that are inside of the community benefit from the revitalization that is going on. And so the council is created or made up of, if you will, of 15 federal agencies and 3 state and regional partners. And every member agency of this council has been tremendous with great passion to help our most vulnerable communities in America. And we have on the council 4 pillars. And I bring this up because the council, when it was created, operates in these 4 pillars of entrepreneurship, economic development, workforce, and education. And as it pertains to this group, the safe neighborhoods pillar of the council. And if you did not know, the Department of Justice is a member of the White House Opportunity and Revitalization Council and has done a tremendous job of being a great partner and a great force and asset to the council in serving our citizens of America. And so as the council moves forward in a singular motion, I wanted to give you just an update. Over the past year, we have traveled to over 60 cities in America, almost 65 cities in America, to host convenings with stakeholder groups such as elected officials and education leaders, community leaders, business leaders, faith leaders. And I want you to have a picture in your mind of all of these stakeholder groups, representatives coming to the table at one time, and we convene and we collaborate together. And so you have elected officials, be it mayors or congressmen or commissioners, coming to the table with community leaders, people that have been in the community for years, along with business leaders and developers and faith leaders, to have those real hard conversations about what is the pain of this community, what is the distress of this community, but then to come together for a collaborate on a strategy for real results for long-term sustainability for that community and revitalization. And it has been a tremendous journey to see people come together. And for all of you to know, man, the Opportunity Zones and the spirit of this transcends politics. It transcends ethnicity. It transcends socioeconomic background, because poverty does not care what party you're in. It doesn't care where you're from. It doesn't care, and you know, who you are. Poverty affects all of us, either directly or indirectly. So when all of us come together for the eradication of poverty and to build citizens up for self-sustainability and for to help them to live the American dream, it really is something to see. And I hope that I'm painting this picture well enough for you. And so we have had these convenings, Mr. Chairman, and I have been, I was counting for a little while, but I think I've been to almost 150, 175 convenings around the country of people coming together. And we have seen tens of billions of dollars invested from the private sector inside of Opportunity Zones. And you may be asking, well, what about the private sector? So this is a public-private partnership when it, as it pertains to revitalization, to invest inside of these communities. We have members from the private sector partnering with the council and partnering with nonprofits and others to invest and strategize for projects inside of Opportunity Zones. And we have created a website, it's opportunityzones.gov, where you can learn about the work of the council, you can learn about the Opportunity Zone legislation. And on that website, which is a great teaching portal, we also have published the one-year report that we gave to the president last December. There's also a first and second volume of a community toolkit. And just yesterday, we published the best practices report on the website to see how cities and localities and local leaders and private sector partners and nonprofits have utilized the Opportunity Zone tool to bring about revitalization in their said cities. Places like Colorado Springs and Birmingham, Alabama, or Erie, Pennsylvania, right here in Dallas, Texas, and St. Louis, Missouri, and a host of others. You will see that on the website, of how the council has moved. You can see some of the things that have been put to use as best practices to bring about real results in these cities. And I encourage all of you to look at that website when you have time. And lastly, I will say in April, the president, in the midst of the pandemic of COVID-19 and all of the things going on in our country, the president in April asked Secretary Carson as the chairman to expand the council to include all of the distressed communities, including Opportunity Zones, for a holistic approach as it pertains to revitalization. And so we have expanded the council. Yes, we are still focused on Opportunity Zones. Our mission is still the same. The spirit of the law and the council is still the same. But in midst of the COVID, in midst of the distress and the severity by which distressed communities have been hit, the president has asked us to expand this council. And so now we are focusing on those same pillars, as I said before, but also now healthcare, access to healthcare with our minority-serving institutions and as it pertains to telehealth and resources in the healthcare industry, also economic development with access to capital for minority businesses to receive this access to capital to build and sustain and grow businesses inside of distressed communities, and also offering them technical assistance to do so. And then from education resources for our distressed communities as it pertains to education choice, as it pertains to distance learning and students having an opportunity to learn from the best teachers around virtually and not just being subject to the zip code that they live in, and also broadband as we talk about these things. So that's the expansion of the council. That's kind of a one year and a couple months update. And I'm very excited to move forward as we recover from the pandemic and from all the things going on in our country. So I just want to say I'm optimistic, I'm encouraged, and I'm looking forward to continuing the great work of the White House Opportunity and Revitalization Council. And thank you all for your help in the Department of Justice. I'm really grateful for your input and your participation.
Thank you, Mr. Turner, for your testimony today and certainly for your leadership.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Our next distinguished panelist today is Reverend Charles Harrison, who is the senior pastor at Barnes United Methodist Church in Indianapolis, Indiana, and president of the Indianapolis 10-Point Coalition. Reverend Harrison began his career in 1984 at the Wiley United Methodist Church in Springfield, Ohio, as a student associate minister. In 1993, he became the pastor of Barnes United Methodist Church, where he currently serves as a senior pastor. Reverend Harrison has been actively involved in many community affairs and events and has received many awards for his achievements, including the Distinguished Martin Luther King Jr. Leadership Award. Reverend Harrison, thank you for joining us today, and you're recognized.
Well, thank you so much, Chairman, and to all the commissioners for this opportunity today to talk about an issue that I'm very passionate about. As has been stated, I am the senior pastor of Barnes United Methodist Church, which is located on the west side of Indianapolis in what has been historically one of the high-crime neighborhoods in the city. I pastor a church of about 700 members. Most of the members that are part of this congregation do not live in the neighborhood. They commute in on Sunday. And then I'm a part of a larger group of pastors that formed called the Indianapolis 10-Point Coalition in the 46208 zip code. And we, as a group of pastors, really wanted to try to address the issue of violence that was plaguing our neighborhoods. And we represent about five different neighborhoods on the west side of Indianapolis. All of us have tremendous programs that are addressing a lot of the social ills that impact particularly communities of color, but we really hadn't gotten involved in the issue of violence. And at the invitation of Mayor Goldsmith, we decided to get involved in a collaborative partnership with the city and law enforcement to try to be involved in community policing and to try to create a community policing model that could directly impact the violence and address root causes in a very profound way. In the community policing model, we tried to bring together, and we really thought that the church community was in a unique position to bring community stakeholders together, the residents in the neighborhoods that we passed, that many who were afraid to really get involved in the community issue, but because churches and pastors got involved, we started getting many residents involved. We tapped into the OG community, ex-offenders, people who were living in the community, turned their life around. Some were in our churches to get them involved. And then most of all, important, the business community, because we would really need them as we were trying to redirect the lives of young men and young women and get them on the right path. And we formed this collaborative partnership with law enforcement. And we have four main goals, or really three that I want to talk about. Could we together reduce the number of homicides that we were seeing that were surging at the time in the community? Could we also reduce the number of shootings and stabbings? And then most importantly, how could we redirect the lives of youth and young adults that were most likely to be the victims and the perpetrators of violent crimes and put them on a pathway of success? In doing this and focusing on this, we knew that it was very important for us to really build a close relationship with law enforcement, and particularly in Indianapolis, the Indianapolis Police Department. Could the churches and community leaders build this very, what we felt like would be a unique relationship with law enforcement so that we would not be operating separately, but how could we operate together to try to impact the violence? One of the things that first happened was when we first started meeting with one another, we really started trying to build the trust level and began to share intel, because there was certain intel that law enforcement had, but there was other intel that we had, whether it came from residents in the neighborhood, from ex-offenders, or from pastors or the church community, about what was really taking place in these neighborhoods that was driving the violence up. And we started identifying individuals and groups that were really a threat to the peace. So in those meetings, we really tried to focus on, when we started strategizing, how could we intervene in violence, how could we prevent violence, and then when necessary, be supportive of law enforcement when there needed to be enforcement in the community. The results were really very dramatic in the community, and we really started this initiative in January of 2016, and we focused on four particular neighborhoods that were high crime in the 46-8 zip code: Highland vicinity, Butler Tarkington, Crown Hill, and the United Northwest area. And in those areas, we really tried to address gang violence, violence that was happening because of drug trafficking, and then dealing with the interpersonal conflicts that was leading also to a lot of the violence. Because of this collaborative partnership, we were able, through the various partnerships, begin to pull individuals out of a life of crime and get them settled into livable wage jobs. They also helped us recruit other individuals to pull them out of the community and the neighborhood who was involved in criminal activity. And over, really, since 2016, we have really seen remarkable results. Highland vicinity has now gone 3 years in a row without a homicide. They are probably about 43 days away from going 4 years in a row without a homicide. Butler Tarkington has gone the last 4 years without a homicide. They are about 93 days from going 4 out of 5 years without a homicide. And then Crown Hill is about 37 days from going 2 out of 5 years without a homicide. And then on the far east side, in one of the worst areas of the city, we just completed our work over there in one of the worst areas in Indianapolis. We were able, through these collaborative partnerships, to go a year without a homicide. The second thing that I think that we really were able to accomplish through this partnership was to build trust between the community and law enforcement. And we all know that, particularly in the Black community, there are a lot of tensions between police and the community. And we were aware of that even in the work that we were doing in these high crime neighborhoods. And as we were on the streets, we would hear the complaints, the concerns that residents had in these high crime neighborhoods. But also in our work with law enforcement, we would also hear their concerns, their frustrations, particularly with what was going on in the community. And a lot of that was also with some of us clergy who would, you know, do press conferences and sometimes point the finger at law enforcement. So what we started to do was, through the Fraternal Order of Police, we started having these dialogue sessions and meetings, really to get to know one another, and that expanded to the patrol officers who were really in these neighborhoods. And we really started having some real serious conversations with clergy, residents, and particularly young men and women in the community that mostly interacted with law enforcement, unfortunately, in ways sometimes that created some of the tension and conflict. And through those meetings that we started having, we started to break down, I felt like, with some of the barriers and some of the trust issues that the Black community had with law enforcement, and then some of the frustration that law enforcement had, particularly working in these areas with the Black community. So as we began to help build the trust between the community and law enforcement, I think it really helped us begin to deal with a lot of the violence in a very serious way. And people started then giving information when it was difficult at first breaking through the code of silence. So as we started breaking those barriers that separated law enforcement and the community, people started coming forward and providing information, particularly in the Butler-Tarkington neighborhood when we had a gang war that took place in the fall of 2015, where four particular gangs were involved in a gang war in that neighborhood. And people had information about what was going on, who was involved, but people were not willing to talk. But when we started developing these meetings and starting to build trust, people then started giving information to law enforcement, which ended up leading to the indictment of GMG, which was the Get Money Gang, and the mob, when people really started giving that information to law enforcement. The third component of this collaborative partnership, I think, is really important, particularly in what we're seeing today in our streets of America. I believe that the partnership between the churches and law enforcement helped deracialize policing in those high crime areas where the tension was high between police and the community. And I thought that was key, because if police are going to be able to effectively police those neighborhoods, we had to somehow deracialize the police in those neighborhoods. And we did it by several things that we did. We would do at least once or twice a month, particularly during the warmer weather, public safety walks where pastors and community leaders would walk the streets with law enforcement so that people in those neighborhoods could see us walking together. And in walking together in those neighborhoods, it also allowed us to engage in conversations between the patrol officers and the community so that we could start building relationships between police and the neighborhood, so that when police would come into the neighborhood, neighbors then began to get to know the officers by their first name, and officers had a chance to really get to know the community by us partnering together. And when something happened in the neighborhood, then black pastors and community leaders would stand with law enforcement during those press conferences to send the message to the community that we stood with law enforcement, particularly when it came to addressing the crime and the violence in our communities. And I thought, you know, that was really key because in the neighborhoods that we have this collaborative partnership with law enforcement, we haven't had any police action shootings, nor have we had any incident in those neighborhoods that has created tension between law enforcement and the community. And I think those are key points that I really wanted to emphasize, is that in this kind of a community policing model that we have adopted in partnership with law enforcement, I really think it's really beginning to break down some of those bridges that have separated law enforcement and the community as we work on this issue of crime and violence together in creating a safer and healthy neighborhoods. So that's my testimony.
Thank you, Reverend Harrison, for your most valued testimony here today, and certainly your great service to the Indianapolis community. Our last distinguished panelist today is Reverend Markell Hutchins, who is President and Chief Executive Officer for the Movement Forward, heeding Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s call to make a career of humanity. Reverend Hutchins has gained national reputation for advocating for fairness and justice. 2009, Reverend Hutchins led more than 100 Atlanta area church pastors and 25 police chiefs in initiating the One Church, One Precinct project aimed at uniting law enforcement with faith-based communities and addressing crime and violence. That work has now gone nationwide through the One Congregation, One Precinct, or the One Cop movement. I've had the privilege of and pleasure of working with Reverend Hutchins for several years, and I'm extremely pleased that he can join us here today. I'd like to make sure everyone knows that the COPS office will be releasing a video interview with Reverend Hutchins today on his One Cop work, and I encourage all of you to view it on our website. Thank you for joining us today, Reverend Hutchins. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Vice Chairman Sullivan, for having me. Good afternoon to all of the commissioners. It is a great honor and privilege to be with you today. Still, there is a certain heaviness that I feel in this hour speaking to this commission that is charged with reviewing the current state of law enforcement in the United States of America. The significance of this moment is not lost on me as I feel the weight of the tragic yet highly complex deaths of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Rashard Brooks, Breonna Taylor, Tyesha Miller, and many others. I also very much feel the weight of the assassinations of Officer Lauren Ahrens, Michael Kroll, Michael Smith, Brent Thompson, and Patrick Zimmerippa, the five Dallas officers who were gunned down while on duty in 2016. I also pause to reflect on the more than 60 officers who have died in the line of duty thus far this year alone, and whose ultimate sacrifices follow other officers who've lost their lives while protecting and serving. I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, cradle of the American Civil Rights Movement, and although I am just 43 years old, I've had the privilege to be mentored and tutored and work closely with many American icons of the Civil Rights Movement of the 1950s and 60s. Over the past two decades, I've sought to carry forth their legacy of nonviolent, peaceful activism on social justice matters. While the current national discussion seems to be centered around police reform that focuses on policies and procedures, I submit to this commission that the greater need is for relational reformation that focuses on how law enforcement professionals and everyday Americans view one another and relate to each other. This is possible only if leaders are intentional about transforming hearts and minds in lieu of mere changes in policies and procedures. The real issue is the implicit bias held by too many officers and too many citizens alike that are deep-seated, pervasive, and often harbored unwittingly. Changes in policy alone won't fix that, but getting to know one another sure will. Commissioners, too often officers don't know the people they are policing on a human level, and citizens don't know their neighborhood officers on a human level. Our charge is to see the world through the unique lens of others whose challenges, difficulties, experience, expressions, and worldviews may be different than our own. While it is easy to fear those whom we do not know, it really is difficult to hate up close, no matter what lens you look through. The connection that we make from one human to another is the source of strength of our families, our communities, and our nation. That connection is at the heart of social change, and it is the means to ensure that American policing lives up to our nation's highest ideals and values. Because I absolutely believe this and have witnessed that hateful views and ignorance can be solved when people get to know each other across communities. Having deep relationships across identities and roles in society helps us to see others as individuals and to avoid applying stereotypes for this reason. Until law enforcement officers become intimately involved with the specific neighborhoods and citizens they police, such that subconscious fears and prejudice are cured on all sides, we will continue to see disturbing incidents like the one in Minneapolis. In my experience, the solutions to our challenges with crime and our current deficiencies with police community engagement will not be printed with ink on a piece of legislation or a list of recommendations or in an executive order. The solutions to the most pressing challenges we face in America today must be imprinted in the hearts and minds of every law enforcement professional and in every American citizen through shared experiences. Law enforcement professionals standing in one corner yelling Blue Lives Matter while protesters stand in another corner yelling Black Lives Matter simply won't lead to reconciliation or to an enhancement in public safety. Community members of every kind and law enforcement practitioners of every kind must sit together and reason together at tables of brotherhood and sisterhood in every neighborhood in our nation. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, "Darkness cannot drive out darkness, only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate, only love can do that." Today we see the fruits of a descending spiral of destruction. We witness the hurt in many black and brown communities who believe law enforcement disproportionately uses force against them. We witness the grief of George Floyd's family, who joined too many families who have lost their loved ones in an officer-involved tragedy. We witness the pain of storekeepers who find the windows of their life's work smashed in by rioters and looters. We witness the deep sorrow of families of officers in St. Louis and Dallas and Las Vegas whose loved ones decided to serve as officers and yet they were gunned down in the line of duty. On some level, it seems that our country is pulling apart, but I choose to believe otherwise. I believe that our darkest hours are always just before the break of a new dawning. Our country has commenced a dialogue that presents a wonderful opportunity for building and healing, and this commission is uniquely positioned as a vehicle to illuminate the goodness of Americans. Based on my experience, I suggest this commission's final report to the Attorney General, the Congress, and the President contemplate and promote the following: shared acceptance of responsibility for public safety by everyone, and by this I mean law enforcement, political leaders, business and corporate leaders, faith and community leaders, and everyday citizens. Strategic and targeted training modules that provide tools to help identify and remove subconscious bias and prejudice while refocusing law enforcement from utilizing a warrior mentality to a guardian service mentality. Investment in recruiting and retaining a diverse law enforcement workforce at every level and a dramatic shift in culture across the board. Underlying these principles is the premise that it is vitally important for each and every citizen and every sector to accept and share responsibility for public safety at the highest level of responsibility that we naturally expect of law enforcement. Communities want law enforcement and order administered equally, regardless of race or socioeconomic status, an ideal that is absolutely American. At the same time, citizens must remember that police have very dangerous jobs, and all of us should respect the burden they carry by following the law and upholding each other equally accountable when someone breaks the law. At this moment in history, officers not only have an everyday job to do, they have an entirely new culture to pursue. A culture that will lead all Americans to seeing officers as real, true, genuine public servants who uphold law and order and carry themselves in such a way that they will always be above reproach. To realize this vision, I want to offer the following 5 specific recommendations to this commission. 1, the immediate scheduling of a White House or DOJ roundtable with corporate and business leaders so that they can bring their expertise and resources to bear to enable law enforcement to become better connected to the populations they serve. Doing this is not only in line with the values of our great corporate sector, but it will also lead to communities in which businesses are able to thrive. 2, the commencement of a new program that will transform the face of law enforcement by dedicating federal dollars to law enforcement recruitment and loan forgiveness for students who commit to law enforcement careers. This program, which I'm calling Police for America, is akin to Teach for America, bringing new people into the field and transforming instead of simply reforming law enforcement policies. To specifically address the diversity and community bridge building opportunity in law enforcement, I suggest starting the program at historically black colleges and universities. 3, The Department of Justice should scale up its grant funding for programs that incentivize law enforcement and collaboration with community groups and organizations. Number four, there should be a significant increase in federal grant making to market positive stories that bring balance to the negative imagery that we see too often about law enforcement. The truth is that for every negative story in the media or in social media, there are thousands of wonderful interactions between law enforcement officers and the public they serve. The Department of Justice and this commission should be responsible for helping put those stories into the hearts and in minds and minds of the American people. And finally, I recommend this commission, along with the Department of Justice, consider hosting a national town hall meeting on policing and community engagement, and I suggest it be here in Atlanta since we are the best city in the world. These five recommendations have at their heart the same core belief that drives the work of movement forward, that we must build bridges across seeming differences. This perspective led me to create and launch the One Cop Initiative, a program that facilitates connections between law enforcement and the populations they serve by leveraging the tremendous assets of faith-based organizations, churches, synagogues, mosques, and other houses of worship. Many departments already have relationships with faith leaders, but there has previously not been a uniform, structured program to maximize those relationships. One Cop is providing that structure. We're taking this concept and principle to scale in October with a powerful initiative we are calling National Faith and Blue Weekend. During this weekend, any house of worship or community organization anywhere in the nation can organize an activity with local law enforcement officers. Every major national law enforcement association has signed on to this initiative, and we're looking forward to hundreds and potentially thousands of activities held across this country in October. We have seen too much calling out in response to tragedies. I think we must do better, much better. We need to call each other not out, but call each other up, call each other together. Officers must cross divides that at times seem to unravel our collective sense of human purpose and decency. Casting stone or blame is not the way forward. Instead, community leaders and officers and citizens must work together with a solutions orientation to create true community policing, and they need help. The United States has an unrivaled corporate sector, a government that can work on a major scale, and a faith community that is unmatched. When we put together these sectors, everyone can rise together. I ask this commission to work collaboratively for the expansion of these ideas and concepts that I've offered you today, because I truly believe that doing these things will reduce crime and violence, improve officer safety and wellness, and drastically increase the collaboration between law enforcement and the communities they serve and protect. Thank you for your time, and thank you for your work.
Thank you, Reverend Hudgens, for your commitment to service and faith, and also for your valuable testimony you provided here today. Commissioners, we're now open for questions to the witnesses. Commissioners with the questions, please state your name prior to your question and direct the question to a specific panelist or the entire panel. This is a reminder to the commissioners, your mics are hot at all times. Thank you, and commissioners with questions for our panelists.
David Roush.
Commissioner Roush, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. So I have a couple questions. One to Mr. Turner, and it may flow into what Reverend Hutchins was just talking about, but curious about how we can incorporate the Opportunity Zone effort into a community engagement effort with the police, if you have any thoughts on that.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Commissioner. So, you know, one of the pillars, as I stated before, was the safe neighborhoods pillar, which the Department of Justice is the lead on that pillar. And so we have engaged with the Department of Justice, and there have been representatives from the DOJ that have gone on these trips. Mike Costigan, to name, has been on a couple of trips with me and the White House Opportunity Revitalization Council as a representative of the Department of Justice and law enforcement inside of opportunity zones. And we also went on another trip together down in Florida to visit a ministry and community engagement activity where they work with reentry, they work with community development between law enforcement and the community. And so DOJ has already been very active and, again, will continue to be active as we get back out on the road into the community to make sure that our neighborhoods remain safe and that the as the pastor was saying, that the relationship between the community, citizens, and law enforcement improves. So thank you for your question.
Yes, sir. I'm sorry, Reverend Harrison, I'm sorry if I could ask one more.
Yes, go ahead.
Thanks. Reverend Harrison, how did you break the barriers that you were talking about there? I'm just curious what the effort was to do that.
Well, there were several things that we did. First, we started having conversations with ex-offenders in these neighborhoods about the relationship that we were trying to build with law enforcement to get feedback from them, you know, as to what they thought about it, because we really needed them in order to really have the serious conversation that needed to happen with law enforcement and individuals who were part of cliques and gangs in the neighborhood. The other way we did it was we had a serious conversation with the FOP, because we knew that the FOP really represented the rank and file and officers. So I had a conversation with the president of the FOP, and we started the dialogue on the law enforcement side. So when we started kind of putting together a framework of the conversation, then we started bringing together in small groups, and we really did it in small groups, where law enforcement were allowed to meet with young men in the community and ex-offenders, and we started having these series of conversations. And it took us several years to really break down those barriers and to improve the relationship between the rank and file patrol officers in the neighborhood and the young men on the streets.
Thank you.
This is Katie Sullivan. I have a question for Executive Director Turner and then a different question for Reverend Hutchins, if you'd allow, Chairman.
Yes, ma'am, Vice Chair, you're recognized.
Thank you. Executive Director Turner, I have a question about, you talked so eloquently about getting to the heart of the matter, the crux of the matter, and poverty. And so I'd like to relate that to the criminal justice system. What comes to my mind are, you know, reentry programs or drug court programs. And if people are unable to pay for those things, then they're not able to necessarily participate in the rehabilitative programs. Have you seen anything, or do you know of any thoughts? Do you have thoughts about that, or do you know of programs that are addressing that that could be modeled across the country? Anything on that particular issue?
Yes, thank you, Vice Chair Sullivan, for your question. And you're right, you know, it is, you know, when we get to the heart of the matter, we can, you know, work together to bring viable solutions. And down in Orlando, Florida, the first one that comes to mind, there is a ministry, a nonprofit, and community-based ministry, with Orlando, World Outreach Center with, Pastor Tim Johnson, that does a tremendous job in this area of reentry and helping people pay for their court costs, you know, through public-private partnerships. And there are also other entities around the country that are doing similar things, and I can get that to you offline, that you can study those and see what people are doing across the country. But it is a tremendous partnership that the administration and others have built. And, you know, obviously the First Step Act, you know, there was a lot of collaboration as it pertained to reentry and court costs and these issues that pertain to reentry for our citizens. And so I can help you further, if you will, offline. Thank you for raising that and bringing that up. But the first that comes to my mind is Orlando World Outreach Center in Orlando. And there are others that we can discuss as well.
Oh, that's great. And we actually heard from Pastor Tim Johnson. So that's,
yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. And the restitution program. Awesome. All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And then Reverend Hudson, I want to thank you, you know, publicly and for reaching out to me on May 30th. And just your words meant so much to me. So first of all, thank you. And you and I had a little bit of an email dialogue, so I don't want to call that out because that was personal. But I know one of the things that we talked about was how do we bridge communities and how do we build bridges of trust when there are sometimes people from outside the community coming in, you know, not totally, but when those outside kind of instigators or inciters are in the community, how do you build the bridges at that point? And then the second thing is I wanted to make sure your idea of having a national kind of conference or dialogue with community leaders and faith-based people and community members, that was an idea that you had brought up in our email, and I wanted to make sure that that got highlighted for the commission. So two different questions there, please, Reverend Hutchins.
Thank you, Vice Chair Sullivan, and I certainly appreciate our ongoing dialogue. The first question that you ask is one that I think is, or the first issue, is one that is overcome when there are established relationships on the front side of these issues. I think one of the things that we have learned is in the aftermath of Ferguson, a department or an agency cannot wait until crises arise to build the kinds of relationships and rapport that are necessary to beat back or to defend a community against the kind of outside agitation that we've seen in certain cities and communities. And I think the research, at least our research internally, has shown that law enforcement agencies that have robust relationships with community organizations on the front side are able to quickly identify who these outside provocateurs are. And I don't mean people who legitimately seek to protest and raise their concerns, but the way in which I think that you're most able to weed out those outside provocateurs who are intent on anarchy is that the agencies have got to have solid relationships on the front side. And I don't mean just a cursory throw a community-oriented police officer at a unit and say, you know, you're all things community-oriented. I mean a deep, deep sense of engagement where the community leaders know those officers, know the department's leadership, and the department leadership knows who those folks are. And when that happens, Director Sullivan, I believe that what happens is those legitimate community organizations, like some of those you've heard about today, are able to themselves call out and weed out those outside agitators who do not seek to demand justice but to wreak havoc. And so that is one way. But I think that's a very robust conversation that needs to happen. I think that the FBI and other intelligence gathering agencies should be a part of that conversation with the local communities. And so that's what comes to my mind in response to that. But secondly, I do think that in this environment, it would really be a missed opportunity if this commission didn't send a strong signal to the nation that the commission and the Department of Justice and the administration is not tone deaf to what is happening on America's streets with people who are crying out, most of them with a sense of legitimacy and urgency. So I think it would be a real missed opportunity if this commission did not put a significant public focus on having a conversation where you bring together stakeholders along with all of our national law enforcement partners to engage in this conversation. How do we heal and move this nation forward? This is a very different moment in time. For example, in Atlanta, yesterday, our district attorney announced on my view, a politically motivated way, charges against an officer or two officers. It was a controversial situation that I personally think deserved more investigation and more consideration and deliberation. But because of the political and social environment that we're in, there is this rush to judgment on all sides of these issues, and we cannot keep going like that. So I just believe that it's a real missed opportunity if this commission concludes your work without having a significant public engagement forum in some format.
Thank you both.
Other commissioners with questions? Other commissioners with questions? Hearing no further questions, let me close by thanking our panelists once again for your time and your most valuable testimony, and certainly your responses to the questions from our commissioners. On behalf of the Attorney General and his leadership team of Rachel Bissick and Jeff Vita and all the commissioners, your contributions provided today are most sincerely appreciated and will assist the commission in their deliberations and work. Also, please check the President's Commission page for additional updates of documents and information on the Maine Justice website. We'll update that regularly when information is available for posting. I want to thank again the FBI for the use of their teleconference network and support, as well as all the federal program staff supporting the work of the commission. Are there any questions or comments from commissioners? Commissioners, thank you again for your travel to D.C., the White House ceremony, and certainly the working session we had with General Barr on Tuesday. It's much appreciated. Please note that we'll have another hearing tomorrow afternoon at 2 p.m. We'll hear from prominent criminal justice researchers. And if there's no further business before us today, the President's Commission is adjourned. Thank you again, commissioners, for your dedication and commitment, and thank you again, witnesses, for your testimony today. Thank you all, and please be safe.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Phil. Thank you, Bill.
And this does conclude today's call. Thank you for everyone's participation. You may now disconnect.